From GPB News, this is listener-supported On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You know, it's never a good idea for a leader to operate on an empty stomach.
At each meal, you know, I used to write him a letter, and I would count, you know, calories and carbohydrates and proteins and grams of fat and let him know how much he was having at each meal.
That's Zephyr Wright. She cooked for Lyndon Johnson during his presidency. And she's part of a long line of African-Americans who've prepared meals for U.S. presidents. Today, we'll serve up some of that history. But first, let's return to a conversation from last week. It was about false equivalency. That's something President Trump was accused of the first time he addressed the tragic events in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists. I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides, I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it.
We broke down what false equivalency means with Ed Lee. He oversees the Barclay Forum for Debate, Deliberation, and Dialogue at Emory University. And he says it's important to be skeptical whenever comparisons involve false equivalency.
What we have to do is to inoculate people in beforehand against false equivalence and other forms of argumentative fallacy, because misinformation is ultimately resistant to correction.
Listener Carl Owens of Vidalia wrote to criticize Ed's take on false equivalence. Carl says Ed was advocating for limited free speech of those in the minority or those with whom the mainstream does not agree. Ed went on to say, quote, Carl went on to say, quote, I assume you'd say that all's well and good when you're limiting the KKK, but not for the LGBTQ community. The left has been using false equivalent arguments for years to promote their views. We're heading into a very dangerous period in our history. End quote. Well, we asked Ed Lee to respond to Carl's comment, and here's part of what he said. Quote, my argument is not that the government or any other actor should prohibit speech that uses false equivalence. Rather, we should not blindly defer to a notion of objectivity that treats all perspectives on an issue as equally legitimate and credible. Ed went on to say, quote, where the listener and I agree is that we should vigorously interrogate argumentative fallacies presented by people regardless of where they are on the political spectrum. End quote. We always love to hear what you think and possibly get responses to your comments. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message, or find us on Twitter and Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Many of us have watched the coverage of Hurricane Harvey, seen the devastation, and wanted to help. And there are a number of Georgia-based organizations working in Texas right now. MAP International is one of them. Steve Sterling oversees that group and joins me from our Savannah studios. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you for having me in Georgia Public Broadcasting.
So what does MAP International do?
MAP International is a Christian health and disaster response organization, and we help all people regardless of ethnicity, gender, or religious belief.
So what has your response been so far toward the hurricane, and did it involve preparations when you knew that it was coming?
Yes, we've been collecting items and purchasing items as well that go into what we call a disaster health kit. And when you leave so quickly from your home, you do not have the basics like soap and washcloths, shampoo, toothpaste, toothbrush. And so we developed this kit, and that also includes antiseptic wipes and other essential items like Band-Aids. And so we've been putting these together and then also sending them through our partners who have boots on the ground with Convoy of Hope in Texas.
So how many, do you have any idea how many you've sent so far?
We've sent over 1,000, and we're packing more right now as we speak. And then we have 10,000 more on order because we know this is going to be ongoing. And so we have also other items that we're shipping with our these health items, other medicines as well. And so we're doing all we can to work with our partners to help meet the needs of our Texans who are in dire need right now.
So, you know, lots of people, as soon as they see a disaster, want to do what they can from where they are. How do you suggest people choose the right nonprofit?
Well, you can always go on Charity Navigator to make sure that you're looking at the right nonprofit with the good standings. And MAP is rated number 2 by Charity Navigator as the nonprofit doing the most good in the world. And so you can look at other...
Yeah, I should mention, Charity Navigator is an independent watchdog of nonprofits. It evaluates them all and gives them scores and tells you, you know, how much actually gets to the people who need it, et cetera, et cetera. So go ahead.
Yes. And also you should look at how long they've been working in that area, because if you see a nonprofit just spring up all of a sudden, you have to really cannot trust them. But MAP has been around for over 63 years, and our partners that we work with, we've worked with many of them for more than 10 years. So we know the people. We know that when they do the work, they actually are doing the work, and their help is needed. They're getting the help.
Now, MAP International has come to the aid of victims in a number of disasters. How would you compare the work you've done for past, especially weather events, with this one?
This the Hurricane Harvey aftermath is probably the largest disaster that we've ever been involved with in the U.S. It is humongous because of the size of the area that's affected, and not only just after 2 weeks, but it's going to go on for a long time. So the basic health needs are going to continue to increase. And so by scale, this was by far the largest in terms of impact that we have seen in this country.
What kind of response are you getting? Are you getting the help that you need from, especially from other Georgians?
Yes, we are. We are getting, I was just speaking at a church yesterday. They took a collection, on Sunday. And they took a collection. There's another school groups that are collecting right around the Brunswick, Georgia area where MAP is headquartered. And so we're getting some good response online, but we could always need more help as this disaster will need to be helped for much longer than just a couple of weeks.
So, you know, there are a lot of people who talk about what is helpful and what isn't. And there are people that sort of criticize the idea that you can just sit at home and send money and that's helpful. But I wonder if as a nonprofit organization, if you would agree with that it's not always that helpful just to send money.
Well, you can, with MAP, you can do both, because actually these disaster health kits, we need to put these together. So we have had volunteer groups come into our large warehouse in Brunswick to actually put these kits together. And these kits could actually be put together anywhere. And that's the beautiful part about it. You can there's 8 components that go into these disaster health kits. So once you put them together, then we actually will ship them to Brunswick where we store them. So you can do both helping, but also these kits cost money. These kits, we had to buy the components. And so any help we can get through the online or any way they can give, we can purchase more of these disaster health kits to give to the people in Texas who need them.
And even in the weeks ahead, the initial...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's going to be months, weeks and months ahead, because it's such a huge footprint this disaster has had on Texas.
That is Steve Sterling. He's president and CEO of MAP International. It's a Georgia-based group that's been helping with relief efforts following Hurricane Harvey. Steve, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Texas's governor estimates that Hurricane Harvey will cost more than the hurricanes Katrina or Sandy. In fact, it could be above $180 billion. We're going to talk about the economic impact of that storm all over the country. But first, a reminder that On Second Thought is only possible. The only reason it's on the air is because of listeners like you. It's because many of you have chosen to become supporters. In-depth coverage like this is expensive, and we are grateful to people who value it and value it enough to support it. Here is Tanya Ott to tell you how you can do that. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The Trump administration is asking Congress for an initial $8 billion for recovery efforts in Texas. The storm caused an estimated $180 billion in damage, and the economic impact of that will be felt all over the country. I'm joined by Emory University labor economist Tom Smith. It's good to have you back.
Well, thank you very much.
So I'm told there are waves of effect, much like ripples in the water when a disaster of this magnitude happens. And we're still in the first wave, right? Assessing damage?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what comes next? And is that, are we going to see an insurance company shut down? I mean, are insurance companies prepared to handle this kind of thing?
Well, I mean, we've never had a natural disaster of this magnitude, and so we certainly would hope that insurance companies have had the foresight to actually price policies out that would cover their costs, and most insurance companies are insured as well, and so it's unlikely that this is going to cause some cascade where insurance companies are failing, so let's hope not. Let's just be optimistic about that.
So then that brings us to your area of expertise, which is the labor that comes after a storm like this. And some people say a storm can actually create jobs. And I wanted to fact check that. Are we creating jobs because people have to rebuild?
No, actually, that's there's a fallacy. It's called the broken window fallacy. And the broken window fallacy kind of goes like this, is that you say, okay, somebody throws a brick through a window, and so that's going to create a job for a glazier or somebody else who then has to clean up the broken glass and what have you. The problem there is that all you're doing is replacing something that used to be in existence. And so that's money that's being used instead of growing. All you're doing is replicating what you had yesterday. And so people like to think that, oh, a big event like this is going to be a big boom to the economy of Houston. It's not. I mean, what you're going to see is that there might be a lot of people who work in the trades, construction and window replacement and what have you, who are going to be very, very, very busy. But then you have to also realize that there's tens of thousands of people whose, livelihood is just, basically washed away. And so you're losing jobs in all types of sectors. And all types of sectors are going to stop in midstream because they don't know what's going to happen next.
So can we look back at things like Katrina and Sandy and make predictions about what effect that may have, such as all the people who have to leave Houston or the surrounding areas because of the storm? Do we know if they return eventually?
Well, the best way to look at this, as you just mentioned, is to sort of look in history and say, okay, the last time we had a big event like this was Hurricane Katrina, and we had tens of thousands of people who left New Orleans, and actually a number of those people went to Houston. What we saw in New Orleans was that, initially unemployment rates went way up, and because you had this lot of people looking for work, people who were displaced, employers that were not functioning properly, and then you had people going to Houston, and you had unemployment rates also go up temporarily because people were looking around for work, and then they settle, but they might not settle the way people like. And so wage rates might go up in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, but they might go down in Houston because you have a whole bunch of people who are, pushing the labor market and then pushing wages down. Here, you're going to have a ton of people leaving Houston. And so the unemployment rate in Houston is going to go crazy. Where those people are going to go? Are they going to go to Atlanta? Are they going to go back to New Orleans? Are they going to go to Arkansas? And we don't know yet.
So what kind of effects might we see here in Georgia and in other states? We're already seeing one of them, right? An increase in gas prices. What else might we see?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. I mean, we've seen a huge, a significant increase in gas prices, mostly because of the Colonial Pipeline and because of the refineries that are kind of out of commission. We do know that that Atlanta is hub to a bunch of consulting companies. I have colleagues who are commuting back and forth to Houston in the petroleum industry. These people are now all hands on deck, if you will, but they're not commuting back to Houston. They're staying put. And so what's going to happen to those jobs? We're not sure. Here, it could be that a lot of the industries that rely on Houston as partners or customers are going to feel, a depression in sales, a depression in the availability of the workforce. And so it's not going to be just because it's, four states over that it's going to be all fine and dandy here. I mean, we're going to feel changes in the way that our economy works in some sectors.
And in the minute that we have left, it sounds like you're saying there could be at least a long period of no growth in Houston. Or is it negative? Might Houston lose ground when it comes to the growth of business?
Oh, absolutely, Houston is going to lose ground. I mean, nobody's going to come out of this saying, oh, that was terrific. We should all hope for a natural disaster in our state to grow our GDP. Houston is in trouble when it comes to their economy. They're going to have years of rebuilding. We're going to look back on this, 10 years from now and say, wow, this is how much they recovered and this is how much hasn't been recovered. You know, we're still sorting this out in terms of the total economic cost of this thing. Some people had estimated that Katrina cost somewhere between $150 and $200 billion. And this is probably starting in those ranges and then increasing from there. And so, you know, even though the president's only asking for $9 billion from Congress, we're talking about multiple hundreds of billions of dollars of economic impact, and it's going to be negative. Nothing positive about this.
That's Emory University labor economist Tom Smith. Thank you so much, Tom.
No, thank you.
Just ahead, a new book will peek inside the president's kitchen with stories of African-American cooks in the White House. These kind of new perspectives and the voices that you hear, these are things you probably don't hear anywhere else. GPB is committed to bringing you this kind of coverage. That's why this show is on the air. But it's also only on the air because you support it. It's our fall fund drive right now, and we need your support to keep this coverage coming. And here is Tanya Ott to tell you how quick and just how easy and fun and happy it is. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk about the history of barbecue and its ties to both politics and, sadly, racism. So what is your favorite Southern food? You can call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Make an argument for a new Southern food, maybe. You can post to Facebook or Twitter. Just be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. For as long as this country has had a president, African Americans have worked in the White House, and especially in the kitchen. But they're often left out of the history books. My next guest wants to change that. Adrian Miller is the author of The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Stories of African Americans Who Fed Our First Families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. And he'll speak tonight at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library and Museum in Atlanta. Hello there.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, you're going to be at the Carter Center, so let's talk about Jimmy Carter first.
Sure.
Because he didn't like peas,
right?
Which is odd because Georgia is famous for its field peas, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about the kind of things that Jimmy Carter had served up for him.
So I think he was very influential in having grits put on the daily menu at the White House. So I wrote a story about that. But a lot of Southern food. In fact, when the Carters were moving in, there's a recorded conversation from the chefs saying, I hope the Carters like Southern food because that's what we serve pretty much every day. Because there's the menu for the cooking for guests and others, but there's also the menu for the resident staff, which was primarily black.
Oh, that makes perfect sense to me. And it's one of the things, that the sort of wrinkles that you bring forward in the book that we don't really think about. But there's other things as well. It's like... And you include, one of the things I love is you include, we're not just talking about the chefs, you're also talking about the butlers and the servers as well. Why is it important to talk about those people who aren't, some of them aren't even cooking the food?
Right, because it was a team effort in order to make the first families happy, comfortable, and healthy. And so you had the people cooking the food, but also, you know, there was a lot of interaction finding out what did the president and the first family like. And making sure that they got the food that they really wanted. So there's really a team aspect to this. That's why I thought it'd be great to expand the story beyond just the kitchen. And also, what happens when the president travels?
Okay, so let's actually hear from one of a big character in your book, Zephyr Wright.
Yes.
Cooked for President Lyndon Johnson for almost 30 years in the White House. In an oral history recording, she's talking about Johnson's battle with his weight.
I wrote him a note and told him that he had been my boss for a number of years, and he always wanted to lose weight, but yet he would do nothing about it. Now I was going to be his boss. Eat what I put in front of him, don't complain, and don't ask for any more. You know, he did pretty good for a while.
See, now this is a side of Johnson we don't often... see,
right?
This African-American woman telling him what he's going to eat, when, and how much.
Oh, it goes even deeper than that. So not only was she keeping him on his diet, but a lot of times he would show up late and demand to be fed and also to also have his guests fed. And she would say, well, you just go sit in the kitchen and wait for me to do it. And
let's actually hear her talking about that. We have a clip of her. This is a part of an oral history featured in NPR story by the Kitchen Sisters.
The first night that I met President Johnson, it was late as usual. He was always late for meals. Now, there have been times that he'd get on the phone himself and call me and ask me how long would it take me to get something ready for the whole cabinet. And sometime he'd walk in with him and you didn't even know he was coming.
How? Tell us about this Zephyr Wright and... I mean, she seemed fierce.
Yes, she was fierce, and she was in many ways a reluctant and an active civil rights advocate. So reluctant is that when the Johnsons were going back and forth between Texas and D.C., she would ride along with the family, but she suffered so many indignities riding through the Jim Crow South that she actually stopped going on those trips. So when Johnson was pushing for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, he actually used her stories to persuade members of Congress to support the legislation. And when he signed the bill, he gave her one of the pens saying, "You deserve this as much as anyone." And the ways that she was an advocate for civil rights is that she was often doing as much cooking as the White House executive chef. So when they fired the White House executive chef, a French guy named René Verdon, because he wasn't doing the cooking the way they wanted, she asked for to be paid the same wages, and she got it.
And she has a popovers. He seemed to love popovers.
Yes.
Now, you only included a couple dozen recipes in there. Why so few?
Mainly because it's really more about the history and the story of these cooks. So I didn't want it to have a cookbook feel necessarily. So I tried to pick choice recipes that I thought accentuated the story.
So we're going to talk more about her because I imagine it's going to take us a few minutes. But tell me about Daisy McAfee Bonner.
Yes. So Daisy Bonner was a cook when Franklin Delano Roosevelt would come to Warm Springs, Georgia. So she was basically lent by a family to cook for FDR. And she got him hooked on all kinds of Southern specialties. Like Country Captain, a chicken curry dish. But one thing that FDR loved was pig's feet. He loved them so much that he actually served them to Winston Churchill in the White House. And we know this because one of the black butlers wrote about it in his memoirs.
Now, how did she prepare pig's feet?
So what she would do is she would broil them, split them, and then butter them. But in the White House,
that
he served...
That is not good for you.
Yeah. In the White House, the recipe he served to Winston Churchill was sweet and sour pig's feet.
That's interesting. Okay, so some of the things that you note in there are some little known, we only have a minute here before we take a break, but mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to point to was the fact in the changing of who pays the salary. Originally, presidents themselves paid the salaries of their personal staff until Harry Truman. What difference did that make?
So that made a tremendous difference because before then, you pretty much had to be a wealthy man in order to be president of the United States because you had to carry the expense of entertaining and paying your staff. We've had presidents of limited means, and usually what they would do to make up for those costs, like Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, is they would raid the army commissary in order to get the groceries. But they had gardening and other stuff like that. But for the most part, you had to be wealthy in order to just carry on the social duties of being president.
And they might have been able to afford larger staffs after Harry Truman when that all changed.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm talking with food historian Adrian Miller. He's the winner of the James Beard Award. His latest book chronicles the stories of African Americans in the White House kitchen. It is fascinating. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're talking with James Beard Award-winning author Adrian Miller, so well known for finding the hidden history of our food and writing it in a way it's just really entertaining. His latest book is The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the stories of African Americans who fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. And Adrian speaks tonight at the Carter Center in Atlanta. So let's talk a little bit about we talked about salary, so let's talk about another monetary exchange that sort of not only reflected changes in society but made a big difference, and that was the tipping of White House staff. How did tipping change, and what did that mean?
So White House workers typically are low pay, especially the African Americans. So tipping was a way to just kind of get supplemental income. And so depending on the first family, tipping was encouraged or sometimes discouraged. And I think Mamie Eisenhower actually banned tipping, and that did not go over well with the African-American staff. So again, it's just a reflection of just kind of less appreciation for the work that African-Americans were doing. So the supplemental income helped.
And to a certain extent, it seemed to have been a disconnect on her part from what her staff really needed. She didn't seem to truly understand that they needed that. That was part of their income.
Right, exactly. And so, I often talk about how these African-American workers in the White House gave our presidents and first families a window on black life. And sometimes presidents chose to open that window and relate and understand the times, and most times they didn't. And so I think that was just one example of, as you well put it, the disconnect.
So let's hear a little bit of more. It's great to have this oral history from Zephyr Wright. Here she is. This is an exchange. So we hear not just Zephyr's voice, but the voice of LBJ's social secretary, Juanita Roberts. And Roberts asks if President Johnson enjoys eating beans.
What would you say if you were asked that question by a responsible person?
Oh, I would say yes.
And
they're going to ask what kind, is it?
No, but I know that he particularly likes pork and beans.
He likes pork and beans, he likes pinto beans, he likes lima beans, green beans.
That's green limas are dried.
Green limas.
I love that. What are some of the other favorite foods of presidents?
So, for instance, George Washington loved green peas. He loved them so much.
Jimmy Carter hated.
Yeah. He loved them so much his contemporaries called him P. Diddy. I don't know if you knew that. No, I'm just kidding.
That is not true. I was like, I did not read that anywhere in the book.
Other interesting examples, LBJ loved barbecue, Tex-Mex, a lot of Southern food.
He's Nixon, Texan, yeah.
Yeah, Nixon loved cottage cheese with ketchup.
What?
Yes. And Ford even had it with A1 sauce.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
And then we know about Reagan loving mac and cheese and jelly beans.
Yeah, jelly beans we all knew about.
But he loved mac and cheese and meatloaf.
So basically, these chefs had to be incredible planners because not only were they cooking regularly for very differing numbers of people, they also had to plan travel.
Yes.
So that the first family always had the foods that they like. And they also had to sort of know what to keep in the kitchen at all times.
Exactly. And they also had to know the dietary restrictions of not only the president, but other members of the first family and guests. So it was very complicated planning. So usually the executive chef or whoever was running the White House kitchen would consult with the first lady and maybe even the chief usher or steward just to make sure that everything's planned out well. And then when they do a state dinner, they actually have to consult with the State Department to know the dietary restrictions of the honored guest. So,
these were highly trained professionals, even going back to the times of Washington. And we sometimes forget in history that there was this whole class of African Americans who were not uneducated and unskilled. They were very highly educated. Some of them, you write, studied in Europe.
Right. So the chef for Thomas Jefferson, who never was a White House chef because he never came to the White House, but when Jefferson was minister to France, his name is James Hemings, one of the older brothers of Sally Hemings. He actually spends 3 years being trained as a classical French chef and becomes Jefferson's chef in residence while he's in Paris.
So tell me a little bit about some of these other stories. You have these great tidbits. For example, they have if they serve fries on Air Force One, they're always soggy.
Right. So what I didn't know, and it makes complete sense, is that on Air Force One, you can't fry because it's unsafe to fry. So often what they do is they kind of pre-make the food at Andrews Air Force Base, and then they reheat it on the plane. So, you know, for a lot of times the food was just kind of military chow. But I understand that in the Obama administration, the food kind of took a notch up.
I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, but also there's this thing that you talk about, which I also found fascinating, which is the lesser P. What's a lesser P?
So I think a lot of people will relate to this. It's when you ask a cook for their recipe and they purposely leave something out so you can't make it the way they did. And Zephyr Wright was famous for that. They just leave one thing out, right?
Right, but was it a key ingredient?
No, it's usually something that just added a little spice or, you know, made it really taste good. But yeah, they would just leave it out on purpose.
So we've got just a little bit of time left. Tell me a recipe that you think from the book, because like I said, there's only a couple dozen. Tell me one that you would recommend people start with.
So I really love a recipe called Jerk Pita Pizza. It was done by Charlie Redden, who was the executive chef of the White House Mess, which is a space in the White House for senior staff. And essentially you get some chicken, you cook it, and then you toss it in some jerk sauce. And then you use your pita as the base. And then you just add the pizza parts on it, you know, call the components. It's really good.
That is Adrian Miller, food historian, soul food historian as well, winner of the James Beard Award. His latest book chronicles the stories of African Americans in the White House kitchen. And it is called The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Stories of African Americans Who Fed Our First Families. Adrian speaks tonight in Atlanta at the Carter Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.